Hey, it's Cameron, host of FP's weekly economics podcast, Ones and Twos. Are you intrigued by how technology like artificial intelligence and cloud computing are affecting geopolitics? Do you care about how governments are using these tools? If so, then I'd recommend checking out Microsoft's Public Sector Future podcast. Head over to aka.ms/public-sector-future to find all the episodes, or just search for Public Sector Future wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ravi Agrawal, Foreign Policy's Editor-in-Chief. This is FP Live. Welcome to the show. Last October, when the Pentagon released its national defense strategy, scholars and policy wonks pored over the document for signs of the long-term thinking behind the Biden administration's day-to-day decisions. And one thing emerged quite clearly, that the White House sees Beijing as its most consequential strategic competitor. China is what is described as a pacing challenge, a challenge not just in the immediate term, but also a growing one in the medium and longer term. But as we know, beyond China, the United States faces a range of other pressing challenges, not least with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but also from North Korea, from the Middle East, and from many other areas around the world. How does the White House rank and prioritize these challenges? How does it adapt to change? My guest today is one of the Biden administration's senior-most policymakers who was instrumental in the drafting of the National Defense Strategy. Colin Carle is the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. He has in the past served as a deputy assistant to President Barack Obama, and he was also Vice President Joe Biden's National Security Advisor. Last but not least, for this audience, he was also an editor of FP's Shadow Government blog during the Trump administration. As always, FP subscribers get to send in their questions, which I sometimes ask on their behalf. If you'd like to do that too, subscribe now. Use the code FPLive for a discount. You can also watch these interviews live in video if you go to foreignpolicy.com/live. For now, here is Colin Carle. Colin Carle, welcome to FP Live.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. So I have to start with the most recent news, the leaked DoD documents. When did it first come to your attention?
Well, I think we've first had word of the unauthorized disclosures on April 6th. And ever since then, it's been all hands on deck. It's been a 24/7 exercise to really understand the scope and scale of what happened and what we can do to make sure it doesn't happen again.
And if you were to assess how damaging the leaks are across a range of issues, I mean, the war in Ukraine, but also more broadly, how would you assess that damage?
Well, I mean, for obvious reasons, not the least of which there's an ongoing investigation, I'm not going to comment on the veracity or validity of the documents. I will say, any disclosure of material purporting to be top secret in nature is a significant challenge for our national security, which is why we're taking it so seriously.
Yeah, I can imagine. There are a couple of things that have emerged. And, you know, I don't want you to comment necessarily if you can't on the veracity of the leaks. But, you know, the suggestion, for example, that Ukraine's air defense system might soon collapse, or the notion that the Pentagon is actually more pessimistic about Ukraine's chances in the war than it has been publicly. Anything you'd like to say on those?
Yeah, again, I won't speak to the documents themselves and what they purport to conclude. I will say this, though, that air defense has been a very top priority for us for the entire war. Ever since the fall and winter, we have really been surging air defense capabilities to Ukraine to include a U.S. Patriot system alongside one that Germany is providing. We've contributed NASAMS systems, other short, medium, and long range air defense and missile defense systems. We're doing everything we can to both make sure that Ukraine's Soviet legacy air defense systems remain viable and that Western systems arrive so that Ukraine can stay in the fight. And I'm confident that we and our allies will be able to do that. In fact, this week, in just a couple of days, Secretary Austin will convene yet another Ukraine defense contact group meeting with 50 some odd countries at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. And I expect air defense to be a top priority there too.
I'll come to that in a second as well. But, you know, Politico reported over the weekend about a mood of real anger at the Pentagon. One official quoted said they were sick to my stomach from the betrayal. What's your sense of any changes being made to clearance structures so we don't have another Jack DeShera pop up?
Well, let's be clear. What happened was a criminal act. The secretary has been clear about that. People who have security clearances have an obligation to protect that information. You should only have access to information that you have a need to know about, and you should never disclose that information publicly. So what happened is a criminal act. That's why there's a criminal investigation underway that the Department of Justice is leading. You know, we already have a lot of procedures in place dating back to previous leaks like the Snowden incident. And so one question really is, were all the procedures that are already in place followed in this instance? If not, why not? And what can be done to make sure things are buttoned up? But then what additional vulnerabilities have come to light as a consequence of this incident, and how can we get after closing those vulnerabilities? And, you know, the Secretary of Defense has been meeting on this issue with his senior leadership multiple times a day since the documents started to appear online. And he has asked his senior leadership to give him concrete proposals in the very near term to make things safer and reduce vulnerabilities. And I think you should expect to see some of that in the coming days.
And that's heartening to hear. Now, you mentioned it's sort of an all hands on deck atmosphere at the Pentagon right now. Are there any strategic changes that are being put in place because of anything that's been leaked, whether or not you can verify any of those leaks?
You know, I'm not going to go into too much detail because I don't want to tip our hand on things, but we have reduced the circulation of certain types of documents during this period, and we'll do a comprehensive review to make sure that only people who have a need to know actually have access to the types of documents we're talking about.
Got it. Okay, so I'll turn away from the leaks now, and I want to take us through a range of topics one by one, but I thought since we were already on Ukraine, we'd go there first. Now, there's little question that the Biden administration has done more than anyone else in material terms to keep Ukraine in the fight. But there's a line of criticism that argues that the White House policy is essentially one of incrementalism. And you could say the same of other countries too, but broadly, you know, the White House often says no to certain kinds of weapons requests. And then a few months later, it goes ahead and sends those weapons in. And I get that needs and demands change, but with the forthcoming spring offensive, how do you see this moment? Is it a moment to go all in, as it were? Why hold off on more attackums, for example?
Yeah, I'll just say that, you know, it's kind of a strange argument to me. So the Biden administration has contributed more than $35 billion of security assistance to Ukraine in a little more than a year. That is an extraordinary amount of security assistance. And the mere fact that we could move that bureaucratically and logistically is a miracle. But the reality was we didn't have $35 billion the day that Russia invaded. In the first 6 weeks of the war, we had a few billion dollars. And so you have to prioritize. You don't have unlimited amounts of money. The taxpayers provide this money. We have to be good stewards of it. So at every stage, as Congress has provided us resources, we have prioritized what Ukraine needed most in that moment. So in the beginning of the war, the priority was understandably on anti-tank systems like Javelin and manned portable air defense systems and artillery and ammunition for Soviet legacy equipment and keeping their Soviet legacy air defense equipment in good shape. As the conflict shifted to the east, we shifted towards transitioning them away from Soviet legacy artillery to NATO standard artillery systems. So we started to send them the howitzers, the 155 millimeter guns, as well as the HIMARS systems that have received so much attention. And what that allowed them to do was to hold the line in the east and then make a breakthrough in the northeast in Kharkiv and also down south in Kherson. As we transitioned into winter and we knew that the conflict was going to transition into a slog, we made two priorities. One was to bolster Western air defense systems. I already mentioned the Patriot systems, but also to make sure that they had sufficient artillery and that we were providing them the armored and mechanized systems that we knew they would need and would need to be trained on for the upcoming spring and summer offensive. So we are all in. We have trained thousands of Ukrainians on how to use systems like the Bradleys and the Stryker vehicles, as well as the Leopard tanks and the Challenger tanks and others that are have flowed into Ukraine. And I think, if the Russians supposedly started their offensive back in January, if you actually look at a map, you can measure their progress in very small increments, sometimes in blocks, in places like Bakhmut. And they have suffered horrendously for those gains. I think we're putting the Ukrainians in a position where once the counteroffensive launches, I think they have a good chance of changing that kind of dynamic on the front lines.
You know, and in a sense, there was a New York Times piece about this recently, about how, in a sense, the leaks have validated some of Ukraine's concerns that they've been airing out in the public, that they're not equipped enough. And I get everything you're saying, but from what I'm hearing, is it just that the restrictions are Congress and funding? Otherwise, you'd be trying to give Ukraine a lot more?
Well, I mean, as I said, Ravi, at every point, what we've tried to do is figure out what does Ukraine need right now? And we do that in consultation with the Ukrainians, of course. And their three top priorities are our three top priorities: air defense, artillery, and mechanized and armored forces, and everything that's needed to maintain and sustain those vehicles. So that is what we've been focused on. We have obviously had an extraordinary amount of money that Congress has given us to provide security assistance to the Ukrainians, but it's not unlimited. So every single time we have to make a decision, one has to ask the question, was it more important to provide a Patriot system on day one of the war, knowing that it wouldn't arrive for months because of the training and the time it would take, or to use that same money, because there's a zero-sum relationship, to provide them Stinger man-portable air defense systems? Well, the answer is obvious. You needed to flow them the Stinger missiles. And right now, a good example is the question about F-16s. We have about $3 billion left in presidential drawdown authority. We could spend all of that money on F-16s, and those aircraft would arrive about a year and a half from now, and they would be, something the Ukrainians would welcome, but they would be completely irrelevant to the spring and summer offensive. So if you have to you prioritize that $3 billion, you're going to spend it on air defense, artillery, and the mechanized forces that they actually need to be successful in the spring and summer. And so we have to make those hard choices each and every day. And I will say, as a general matter, we have not held things back. It's when things have appeared have basically been dictated by how things have changed on the ground in Ukraine.
I hear you about the tough choices and, the constraints of funding. And given that we're talking about that, how do you feel about the road ahead in America, given that at least, one or two Republican candidates or would-be candidates for president have said that America should focus more on China instead of Ukraine? There are also polls that suggest that in the Republican sort of base, at least, there's less appetite or declining appetite for supporting Ukraine. If you game that out longer term, it could be that it gets harder and harder to raise additional funding for Ukraine. Given that reality, how are you thinking about the constraints changing in this dynamic?
Well, look, as I said, Congress and ultimately the American taxpayer has been extraordinarily generous in providing security assistance to Ukraine, but it's not charity. The free world has a stake in the outcome in Ukraine. Obviously, for the Ukrainians, it's existential, but for the broader international community, there is a test, and that is, do we want to live in a world that is governed by the rule of law or the law of the jungle, where large countries can swallow their smaller neighbors and the world just moves on? And I think if we don't assist the Ukrainians in beating back Russia's aggression, you're likely to see Russia do this again. It could do it somewhere else in the former Soviet space or against NATO. Or you could see other would-be aggressors in other part of the world draw the lesson that the international community will not stand up to smaller besieged democracies as their larger authoritarian adversaries go on the march. So I think that there remains a bipartisan consensus that the United States has a compelling national interest in assisting Ukraine. I do hear the same voices that you've heard. I think sometimes they are loud, but I think they represent a minority, to include on the Republican side. And I think that there is substantial bipartisan support for Ukraine. And I hope that that will be sustained going forward. I will also say, a lot of people have predicted for a long time that support would fall off internationally as well, not the least of which in Europe. A lot of people predicted that, you know, through the winter, for example, as gas prices and energy prices went up, that Europe would kind of lose its nerve on Ukraine. It hasn't happened. And in large part, that's because Europe obviously has a strong stake in this conflict and because of the leadership of the United States, not the least of which my boss, Secretary Austin, who is meeting once a month in these Ukraine defense contact groups. I made reference to the meeting this week at Ramstein, but is on the phone on a daily basis to make sure that the coalition in support of Ukraine around the world remains intact.
Undersecretary, how do you think through nuclear escalation? A lot has been written and said about this topic, but a year has gone by. Putin hasn't used nuclear weapons so far, obviously. Has your risk assessment changed over the last year? In other words, as you think about giving Ukraine what it needs today, do you think that Putin is less likely to up the ante to a nuclear level because he hasn't so far?
Yeah, I think this is another misnomer that we have somehow held back on a large number of things out of concern for escalation. We have expressed our concern about U.S.-provided equipment and material being used to strike targets inside of Russia. But by and large, we have not held things back because of a concern for escalation. After all, if Russia is worried about the consequences of the war for Russia's security, Vladimir Putin can stop the war tomorrow. And that problem is solved. So look, in the exchanges that we've had with Russian officials, they have constantly made the point that Russia's nuclear doctrine has not changed, that they would only use nuclear weapons in the event of an existential threat to the Russian state. We don't think the war poses that threat. But President Biden has also made clear that while we will do everything we can to support Ukraine, the United States does not have an interest in directly entering the conflict and seeing the conflict escalate to World War III either. So we will continue to measure what we do against the risks, not only for what's going on in Ukraine, but for the conflict spilling over and having broader implications for U.S. national security. And I think the American public would expect us to do nothing less.
How does the Pentagon think about the potential for a negotiated settlement? So under what conditions and circumstances would or could such talks begin? And I ask because it's not just the U.S. that has an interest here, but in recent weeks, several countries, Brazil, China, I'm hearing murmurs from India as well, where several, you know, world capitals are sort of raising their hands and saying, oh, we could help negotiate an end to the conflict. But how does the Pentagon see all of that?
Well, look, first of all, we're not going to be in the position of imposing a set of terms on the Ukrainians. They were the ones who were invaded, further invaded. After all, Russia absorbed Crimea back in 2014 and started the war in the Donbass back then, too. So we're not going to tell the Ukrainians, you know, what a peace settlement will look like, what their terms or conditions will be. They put forward their own peace proposal, one that is grounded in a set of foundations that the vast majority of countries on planet Earth subscribe to. We are regularly seeing these UN General Assembly resolutions in support of Ukraine get around 140 countries in support of it. So our position has been that when and if Ukraine is ready to sit down and negotiate, and they have a willing partner on the other side with the Russians, that the Ukrainians are in the best position to negotiate from a position of strength. So I don't think that negotiations are imminent. I think that you're likely to see fighting for a number of additional months. I think you're likely to see quite intense fighting in the coming months as both sides jockey for advantage on the battlefield. But in the event that Ukraine's expected counteroffensive proves successful, that will put them in a better position. Now, at that point, whether the parties pivot to negotiations will ultimately be up to the two sides. But we are not going to impose that outcome on the Ukrainians.
So last question on Ukraine. Speaking about the battlefield, what are you expecting, or what can you tell us about what to expect from a forthcoming spring offensive on Ukraine's part?
Look, I think we all have to be humble about making predictions about the way that the war in Ukraine is going to evolve, because a lot of those predictions have proven false. But the one thing that hasn't proven false is that you shouldn't underestimate the Ukrainians. They've been extraordinarily innovative, creative, resilient, and of course, they're fighting for their very existence. So I think that with a lot of help from the United States and our allies and partners, the Ukrainians have been able to build up several additional brigades of combat power. I think as the weather turns and is more favorable to using the type of armored and mechanized equipment that have been provided to them, I do think the Ukrainians will have opportunities to change the kind of dynamic that you've seen on the front line since the winter, which has kind of been this Bakhmutization of the conflict, where the two sides have fought over very small slivers of terrain, trading city blocks and small parts of towns and countryside. But the map is not fundamentally different than it was 3 or 4 months ago. And so I think they will be in a position to change that dynamic. The other thing that I think we can be certain of is that regardless of the outcome of the counteroffensive, Russia has already lost. By every measure, Putin's objectives have not been fulfilled, and they will not be fulfilled. He wanted to wipe Ukraine off the map and absorb it into a broader Russian empire. That didn't happen. It's not going to happen. A sovereign, independent, democratic Ukraine will survive and endure. There's nothing the Russians can do to change about that. He wanted to invade Ukraine to demonstrate Russian power. Russia's going to emerge from this conflict weaker than it was going in. He wanted to go in and divide the West and weaken NATO. He's generated the exact opposite effect. So I think regardless of the outcome of the spring offensive, the one thing that we can say for certain is that Russia's already lost.
You are listening to Foreign Policy Live. Remember, you can watch these conversations live and on video on our website, foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers get to send us questions in advance, so sign up. Use the code FPLIVE for a discount. Let's get to China. There's little doubt that China's actions have contributed to greater fears in the United States about great power competition. Your administration calls it a pacing challenge. But I have to ask, isn't some of this a self-fulfilling prophecy? In other words, how do you think through policymaking with an eye to not creating an escalatory spiral of sorts?
Look, it's something we have to be mindful of. First of all, those two words, pacing challenge, were both chosen intentionally, not pacing threat, pacing challenge. The challenge because China is the only country in the world that has increasingly has the capability, military, technological, economic, diplomatic, to challenge the United States and the intent to do so, to displace the United States as the world's leading power. But this isn't some game of King of the Hill. They want to displace the United States because they want to rewrite the rules of the international system in a way that favors the PRC's interests and values, and in particular, the interests and values of the Chinese Communist Party. And a world in which China is the world's leading power and the world is made safe for the CCP would be one where the interests and values of the United States, I think, would be at risk. So that is why they are our pacing challenge. But conflict with China is not imminent or inevitable. So just because they are a challenge does not mean that we should invite a conflict. It would be devastating for everybody involved and create unbelievable collateral damage to the world economy. And it would be a conflict between two nuclear powers. So nobody wants that outcome. Nobody should invite that outcome. But the reality is that the PRC has ambitions to establish a sphere of military and political influence in the Asia Pacific and abroad that threatens U.S. interests and also those of our allies and partners. And we're going to defend ourselves and our allies and partners. So if the answer is we should do nothing, then I think the outcome is that you're likely to see China expand its influence and power in ways that run counter to our interests and those of our allies and partners. On the other hand, you don't want to take actions that overheat and overcrank the situation and spiral. And so what we've been trying to emphasize is that we will be responsible. We do not look to unilaterally change the status quo. We don't support others unilaterally changing the status quo. We do not want a conflict with China. In fact, in all of his interactions with President Xi Jinping, President Biden has emphasized the importance of putting guardrails around our competition, emphasizing strategic stability, crisis communications. And, you know, Xi Jinping often leaves those meetings saying the right things, but the reality is the PRC is not picking up the phone when we're calling them. When you have crises around a, you know, Speaker of the House visit to Taiwan or the recent transit by the President of Taiwan through the United States, our outreach to the PRC is largely ignored. So I think it's incumbent upon both sides to make sure that we do build these guardrails so that we don't have the spiral and self-fulfilling prophecy that you referenced.
You just said when you call China, no one picks up the phone. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? So during the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviet Union had a hotline to defuse crises. So you're saying there is some sort of a mechanism with China, but they're just not responding?
Yeah, the problem is not a technological one. We can pick up the phone. There's a link. That call can be unclassified. It can be secure. It can happen at a moment's notice in military channels or political challenges. That's not the problem. The problem is political will on the other side. And I think a couple of things are going on here. First, China has a very centralized system. So Xi Jinping doesn't like to empower his subordinates to have contacts with the United States without his explicit permission. So that kind of slows down connections below the very top and or requires getting permission all the way up to Xi Jinping himself for those contacts to happen. Second, I think that China has just a different theory than the United States and the Soviet Union had during the Cold War. I think coming out of the Berlin crisis, but especially the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a sense in both Moscow and Washington that the two sides had to communicate with one another to prevent Armageddon. And that whatever differences we had and wherever we were competing in Europe or Asia or the Middle East or across other parts of the developing world, there had to be that link to avoid that competition spiraling into the abyss. I think China has a very different view. They seem to have the view that crisis communications will be an excuse for the United States to create more crises so that we can then manage them. And that if we want to avoid crises, there's a simple solution, and that's just to get out of the Western Pacific and to abandon our alliances and partnerships and leave that part of the world to be an exclusive sphere of influence lorded over by Beijing. And that's just that's a theory that's very incompatible with the types of robust crisis communication. So again, this is an issue that President Biden has raised with Xi Jinping on a number of occasions. Xi has said that he's committed to improving these types of communications. We just haven't seen it manifested yet.
That's a bit worrying. A longer term question here that I think doesn't get asked enough in Washington is, where is all of this headed? So you have this China policy and a defense policy. You describe China as a pacing challenge, and one can agree or disagree on the margins. But given how China responds and how it too has its own domestic constraints, where do you see this competition headed 5, 10, 15 years from now? And what kind of outcome would strike you as a good outcome for Washington?
Well, look, I think, you know, at the Department of Defense, our primary job vis-a-vis the PRC is deterrence. That is, it's important that the PRC leadership wakes up every single day and says today is not the day. Today is not the day to launch an invasion across the Taiwan Strait or to challenge U.S. allies in the South China Sea or the East China Sea, or to engage in other aggression that could threaten the rules-based international order, the global economy, U.S. interests, the interests of our allies and partners. So again, we do not seek conflict. It's not in our interest, but we will maintain and sustain and grow over time the military capabilities to ensure that China understands that there is no benefit that is worth the cost that would be imposed were they to go down the road of military aggression in that part of the world or anywhere else. The good news is, I think that our deterrence vis-a-vis the PRC remains robust today, and that we are making enormous investments to make sure that that deterrence is strengthened and sustained over time. I mean, the most recent budget that was submitted to Congress is $842 billion. And that includes massive investments in the capabilities that will determine whether the U.S. deterrent remains viable. So it includes nearly $38 billion to continue modernizing our nuclear triad. It includes nearly $30 billion for missile defense, $11 billion for long-range fires, $33 billion in investments in space architecture, which are key to the American way of war, more than $13 billion in cyber. And the list goes on in terms of the investments we're making in air power, in sea power, in undersea power, which is a very significant area of overmatch for the United States, and in the land domain to modernize those forces to be more relevant and more survivable in a Pacific scenario. So I say all of this because our deterrent remains robust today. I do not think the leadership in Beijing doubts that for one moment. And when they look at the military that we were building over time, I think that that deterrent will remain real for years to come.
There's a phrase you use there, Undersecretary, today is not the day. And it's similar to another phrase I often hear in discussions about Taiwan, which is to raise the costs so high that China wouldn't consider attacking Taiwan. But all of this also sounds to me like it's kicking the can down the road. And so, you know, this comes up in many war games I know that often show that China could take Taiwan, but you just want to deter it from doing so, even if it could eventually achieve victory. But I guess what this sort of leads me to then ask is, eventually it seems like China could take Taiwan, and all you can do is delay that, right?
I don't think that's true. Look, the PRC is going through the most breathtaking military modernization any country has gone through since the 1930s, really. Certainly in the post-World War II era. And in many respects, the PRC has seen the United States as their pacing challenge probably since the 1990s, from the Gulf War and then the incident with the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the war in the Balkans at the end of the 1990s. And they have invested massively in trying to hold at risk the U.S. joint force in space, in cyberspace, our bases in the Indo-Pacific, our aircraft carriers, you name it. They have invested in trying to hold the joint force at risk. The reality, though, is that our deterrent right now is real. I do not think that the Chinese leadership believes that their military is capable of taking on the United States right now. The question is, over time, will that calculus change? And so, yes, the time is sliding forward, but we are also moving forward. And the investments that we've made in the three budgets since President Biden came into office under the stewardship of Secretary Austin are precisely to build that capability so that even as China's capability grows, ours is pacing to that challenge. And therefore, the day is never the day. So you're right to some degree that we're just sliding things in time. But we also did that during the Cold War for 4 or 5 decades. So there is the capability to maintain deterrence over time, and then over time, build increasing guardrails for stability, such that you're not worrying on any given day that the other side is going to commit aggression that could pull the two sides into conflict.
I have to ask, why is Taiwan such an important defense priority? And I ask because surely this isn't just about democracy, because if it was, Washington would care more about democracy in some of the other parts of the world as well, whether it's India or Israel or any number of other troubled democracies. So, you know, in defense terms, for you at the Pentagon, what is it exactly?
Well, I'll say that this, it's not, Taiwan is not a defense priority per se. It is a U.S. national security priority, of which the defense priority is nested under that. And it's not something that the Biden administration imposed as a priority on the United States. It's something that there's been bipartisan support for going back to the Taiwan Relations Act. So under the Taiwan Relations Act, there is a bipartisan agreement that it's in the U.S. national interest to ensure that Taiwan has the ability to defend itself, and that the United States maintains the capacity to prevent a forced change in the status quo across the Taiwan Strait. Now, just to make clear, our policy has not changed. Our one China policy has not changed. We don't support a unilateral move by either side to change the status quo. We don't support forced reunification by Beijing, and we don't support independence by Taiwan. But the reason that Taiwan matters is not just because of the fact that the island could be used as a platform for the PRC to further project military power deeper into the Pacific, but also because Taiwan is a vibrant democracy of 29 million people, because Taiwan is the leading producer of the most advanced microelectronics in the world. And Taiwan, as an economic entity, matters an extraordinary amount to the global economy. A war across the Taiwan Strait is not just something that would impact American lives and American prosperity. It would impact the lives and prosperity of people all around the world. So no one has an interest in a war breaking out across the Taiwan Strait. And I think our, you know, national defense strategy recognizes that reality.
So let's get to the broader national defense strategy, the document that your administration came out with last October publicly. It's been a few months now. There have been a fair number of assessments out on it already. What's the area that you think critics misunderstand about the NDS?
Well, that I think actually one of the critiques that I've heard is that the concept of integrated deterrence, which is really a cornerstone of the NDS, is somehow passing the buck from the military to other parts of the U.S. government. And nothing could be further from the truth. So obviously, we're making enormous investments in our military. We have to be able to deter military conflict with the might and capability of the U.S. joint force. But what the concept of integrated deterrence really means is that as we do that, we need to make sure that we are folding in new technologies and domains like cyber and outer space that will increasingly define the future of warfare. We also have to fold in our allies and partners, because one of the asymmetric advantages that the United States has, whether it's in the Indo-Pacific or Europe or anywhere else, is the strength of our alliance and partnership network. So, of course, as we try to deter aggression, we have to integrate our allies and partners into that equation. And yes, we have to integrate other instruments of U.S. power into that equation, too. That means our diplomacy, it means our intelligence, and it means our economic statecraft. And if that sounds weak and wimpy, I think people aren't drawing the right lessons from the conflict in Ukraine. Yes, the provision of enormous amounts of security assistance to Ukraine has imposed tremendous cost on Russian aggression. But so has diplomatic isolation. So have economic sanctions. So has our use of intelligence in the information space. And I guarantee that if you're sitting in Beijing, you're asking yourself the question, if I go after Taiwan, will the world react the way they did in Hong Kong or Ukraine? If it's Hong Kong, they'll be able to snuff out and absorb a vibrant democracy into Greater China, and the world will kind of yawn and move on. If it's Ukraine, not only do you run the risk of a devastating conflict that leaves you weaker, not stronger, leaves the world more united against you rather than more divided, not only do you face those military realities, you also face the prospects of diplomatic isolation and economic costs, sanctions, export controls, et cetera. And the big difference between the PRC and Russia is that it is impossible for China to achieve its ambitions for national greatness in the decades to come without being integrated into the world. So, of course, if you were thinking about committing aggression against the Taiwan Strait, the big question is not just the military one. It's, will it leave China weaker and more isolated politically and economically? So I say all of that because, of course, as we're thinking about deterrence, it needs to be integrated across the various tools of U.S. statecraft, in addition to our allies and partners, all backstopped by the most formidable military in the history of the world.
You know, I noticed part of the strategy in the document that was released as well was to rely on alliances. Talk to us a little bit about that, especially in light of the fact that we seem to be entering a new and more multipolar order of sorts. You have the rise of minilateralism, of smaller groups. I mean, obviously, there's the Quad, which the U.S. is part of, but there are other smaller groups that do not include the U.S. You frequently have countries like China stepping up to mediate between, say, Saudi Arabia and Iran. The world seems more fractured in a sense. We often hear the phrase non-alignment or multi-alignment for the first time in decades, I would say. How does alliances fit into the broader strategy?
I mean, in the first instance, it's because they're the focal points around which we engage in collective action of any kind to address any global challenge. So obviously, you know, whether it's the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the role that NATO and our other alliances have played in rallying support for Ukraine, or whether it's the way our alliance networks are adapting to the challenge posed by the PRC in the Indo-Pacific. So think about how much deeper our cooperation on defense issues has gotten with Japan, from a posture perspective, from the amount of resources that Japan is investing, the types of capabilities they are investing, or look at the recent progress we've made with the Philippines on the EDCA sites and the other diplomacy that we're doing to enhance our defense relationship with the Philippines. And Secretary Austin has, again, played a lead role in all of that with his various trips to the Philippines. He just had his Philippine counterpart here last week for a 2+2 alongside Secretary Blinken to strengthen that relationship. Or look to AUKUS, which connects two of our alliances, our bilateral treaty relationship with Australia, to our closest ally in the world, the Brits, and pulls them together to create a conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarine that will strengthen deterrence in the Indo-Pacific, but also has other components on other high-end technologies that will have real and meaningful benefits to warfighters and therefore strengthen deterrence. So look, our allies, they're our team. They're the team that we go into this competition with. And, you know, I've sometimes said that really, to your point about how much the world is changing, this is not a competition of countries. This is a competition of coalitions. And nobody is able to marshal the size of the coalitions that the United States is. I've mentioned a couple times the upcoming meeting that Secretary Austin will have at Ramstein. That's 50 countries. That's not just NATO. Those are countries in Africa and the Middle East and
in
Asia.
Can I ask then how you define or what makes for a coalition? What is the unifying theme that creates a coalition against another coalition? And I ask because, again, it often seems unsatisfying to go the democracy autocracy route, which is very black and white and doesn't really fit many of the countries we're thinking about.
Yeah, I think this is another misnomer about the policy of the Biden-Harris administration. You know, the president is fond of talking about what he calls the free world, which is, you know, a concept that's been around for a while. But I think people misunderstand what that term actually means. I think the inner circle of the free world is the United States and the other advanced liberal democracies of Europe and the Indo-Pacific that are at its core. One ring out are a set of democracies that are partners of the United States. Think of India's participation in the Quad. You referenced the Quad earlier. And one ring out are countries that may or may not be democracies. They may have authoritarian governments, but nevertheless, their security, prosperity, and way of life is highly dependent on a free and open international system. So the free world is all three rings the advanced liberal democracies that form our core alliances, our liberal part, our democratic partners, and countries that may not be democracies that nevertheless depend on a free and open international system. That is our coalition. Now, the membership of that comes in and out. And sometimes the exact coalition is going to be defined on the issue. And not everybody is going to share a U.S. perspective on a given problem. And that's okay. We don't have to say that there's one team and you're going to cooperate. You're either with us or against us on everything. That's not realistic. That's never been the way that the world works. It cannot be the way that the world works forward. But if you're asking yourself, what country is capable of bringing forward the most potent team as measured in economic capabilities, military capabilities, diplomatic heft, the ability to actually galvanize international cooperation around the most important problems we face, it's clear that nobody holds a candle to the United States.
Sure. I'll just point out, you called it a misnomer, but of course, President Biden has talked about aligning democracies against autocracies. But I take your point. We're getting many subscriber and viewer questions in from around the world. I know we don't have much time, but there's a common theme across the questions, and many of them are about China. John Ball, James Day, just to sort of combine their questions, are asking how you see, quote unquote, winning the competition with China. How should the DoD measure success?
Well, look, for the Department of Defense, winning means maintaining a free and open rules-based international system. So it means protecting our interests, protecting the homeland, preventing strategic attack, preventing aggression, especially in parts of the world where our interests are most at stake, such as the Indo-Pacific or Europe. So that's what winning looks like, is preventing the really bad outcomes and then fostering the types of cooperation that are required to sustain that deterrence over time and cooperate to disrupt other activities that threaten our interests. That could be violent extremist organizations, which continue to rear their head. It could be cyber criminals. It could be other challenges. So that's what winning looks like. But of course, we're only part of the equation. A big part of this is investing in ourselves as a country. That's why the Biden administration has worked alongside Congress to make massive investments in science, technology, infrastructure, education, addressing the existential threat posed by climate change, precisely so that we can position the United States across the board to win the future.
I have a great question in from Major David Phillips from the Air Force. He says, is the U.S. government and the Biden administration doing enough to communicate with the American people at large about the challenges and threats posed by an increasingly aggressive and assertive China?
You know, I think we're communicating a lot. You know, whether it's enough is probably a little bit in the eye of the beholder. You know, if you look at the national security strategy, it identifies China as the most consequential competitor of the United States. If you look at the national defense strategy, which we've been talking about, it identifies the PRC as our pacing challenge. If you look at our investments, whether that be in technology or in infrastructure or even on climate and defense, they are all oriented around competing with China in one way or another, and making sure that we're doing that in a way that serves U.S. interests and is consistent with U.S. Values. And we've made the case. And the other point is, I just think that there's a strong bipartisan level of support for doing all of those things. You know, there's a lot of polarization in this country. There's a lot of disagreement on a lot of things. But I think there's a real opportunity to continue to marshal our competitive spirit to rise to this challenge and keep that bipartisan support going to provide the resources that it's going to take.
Our subscriber, Brian Gallagher, has a question on an issue I wanted to get to but couldn't, so here we go. When we think of a conflict with China, he says, we're at a significant people and manufacturing disadvantage, but more worrying, he says, is that China has a large advantage in raw number of software and AI experts. How does the Pentagon think through AI competition between the U.S. and China? Do you agree? Are we at a disadvantage? How do we not be at a disadvantage?
You know, look, I think sometimes people, you know, look at the remarkable rise of China's economy, decades of 7, 8, 9, 10% growth. and their aspirations to, dominate the commanding heights of the technologies that will define the rest of this century: artificial intelligence, quantum, synthetic biology, space. And, you know, basically think that somehow the United States is in the rear view mirror in that equation. I think nothing could be further from the truth. I don't really know a lot of Americans who would raise their hand and say, I'll trade places with China. I think history is littered with countries, to include great powers, that have underestimated the United States. I also think that China's got its own challenges. They have a massive demographic problem. They are rapidly aging. Their population is starting to shrink. And the number of young working age people that can support that aging population is not what it needs to be for sustainable growth rates. They have enormous environmental and resource challenges. Under Xi Jinping, they have consolidated political control even more with an iron fist under the CCP. It's not clear whether that is sustainable for the aspirations of the Chinese people over time. They have enormous debt overhang. They have a lot of problems. And it wasn't China that created ChatGPT. Now, to be fair, it wasn't the Pentagon either. But I wouldn't count American industry out. I mean, I joke about ChatGPT, but it's actually maybe an interesting example, because there's a debate going on in China right now. Why didn't a Chinese company create ChatGPT? And at least part of the answer is it's hard to create a large language model that scours the entire internet to generate solutions to problems if you censor the internet. So I actually think that there are enormous investments, especially in the private sector, that will keep us at the bleeding edge. And really, our responsibility here in the Pentagon is to make sure that we can nurture that ecosystem and draw on it as necessary to keep the military edge sharp as well.
China did create TikTok, of course. One last question, Undersecretary, on Iran. I have to ask, did the Biden administration miss a step in not trying to get back into it sooner? And I guess more pertinent to your role today, how exactly is America deterring Iran? How do you feel about Iran being closer to a nuclear weapon?
I think, people can debate whether the administration was too fast or too slow out of the gate in trying to revive negotiations with the Iranians. I'm not going to get into that. I wasn't part of the administration at the outset. I'm looking at where things are now. And the reality is that the JCPOA is essentially on life support, barely. You know, when the JCPOA was in place, Iran's breakout time to create one bomb's worth of fissile material would have been about a year. Now it can be measured in a small number of weeks. And so we're not in a great place. President Biden has made clear that Iran will not be allowed to acquire a nuclear weapon, period. He's made clear his preference for a diplomatic solution to that problem, but we have other alternatives available to us. You know, I'll give you one just recent example. You know, if you look back in January, the United States and Israel conducted the largest military exercise in the history of our relationship with Israel. About 6,000 U.S. service members joined their counterparts in Israel, a U.S. aircraft carrier, live fire exercises that involved something like 180,000 pounds of munitions, a lot of activities in the air, aerial refueling, search and rescue, demonstrating a lot of joint capability to defend our interests in the Middle East. I have no doubt that Iran took notice of that. You also saw the recent attacks by Iranian-backed groups against our forces in northeast Syria, and you saw the forceful counter response by the United States that I think, at least for some period of time, has restored a modicum of deterrence. But it may not last. And if it doesn't, and Iranian-backed groups hit us again, we will be poised to defend ourselves. And the president and Secretary Austin have made that clear. So deterrence is not something that just exists and then it stops and then it's gone forever. It's something that exists. You have to nurture, you have to strengthen. And when it erodes, you have to build it back up. And when it collapses, you have to restore it. And so it's an iterative process. And it's one that we're engaged in Europe, in the Indo-Pacific, and in the Middle East.
And that was Colin Carl, the U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. Next week, John Kerry. He's President Biden's special climate envoy. He's also a former Secretary of State. You heard Colin Carle say nobody in Beijing is picking up the phone. Well, John Kerry has a direct line to his counterpart in Beijing, and he does pick up the phone. We'll explore whether that connection between America and China could just end up saving the world. Remember, if you want to watch these live in video, go to foreignpolicy.com. Subscribers can submit questions in advance and help frame these discussions. Sign up, use the code FPLIVE for a discount. You can also see what else we have coming up on the show weeks ahead of time. I'm Ravi Agrawal, FP's editor-in-chief. I'll see you soon.
Hi, I'm Annalise Riles, professor of law at Northwestern University. I'm also an anthropologist and the host of a new podcast, Everyday Ambassador, where we give you the small tools that make big change. The idea for this show has been a long time in the making. I actually remember the exact day I started thinking about it. It was March 11th, 2011. I was in Japan conducting research on the financial markets of Tokyo. All of a sudden, I heard a loud rumbling sound and the room started shaking. Everything came crashing off the shelves. I looked out the window and I could see the skyscrapers swaying so much that they looked like they would touch. And then the sirens started going off. A tsunami was on the way. These were the harbingers of one of Japan's worst ever disasters, the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
The Japanese government now says two reactors are in partial meltdown and four more are at risk.
The meltdown completely turned Japan on its head. I saw hundreds of stunned office workers covered in dust walking down empty train tracks to get from the city to their homes in the suburbs. Electricity was out, internet, cell phones. Supplies flew off the shelves of stores. Geiger counters became an in-demand item, which is never a good thing. Living through a crisis of this magnitude was an inflection point for me. To prevent the next Fukushima or any of the other crises we face today, we'll have to work much more effectively across silos of expertise and national boundaries. And we'll need to harness the wisdom of everyone, from local fishers to nuclear physicists, on how the world really works and what happens when things go awry. Using this approach, I've gone on to spur countless innovations in global policy. And that's what this podcast is all about. Everyday Ambassador peels back the curtains of high-stakes leadership and gives everyone backstage access to the most powerful methods of diplomacy. In each episode, we'll break things down into deceptively simple moves that everyone can make to help build a more peaceful and sustainable world. Like giving a gift.
You want to make it tasteful. You want to make it thoughtful. You thought about the other individual. You thought about what their likes and dislikes are.
Or creating a fiction.
Taking on a fictional scenario and a role outside of the one that you occupy in your day-to-day life allows you to think through what you would like to have done differently.
Or just taking the time to have fun.
Trying to see this as more so building long-term relationships that are going to be helpful down the line when negotiations are a bit harder, as all negotiations are.
Each week, you'll hear surprising stories which reveal the moves you can make to change the status quo, to find ways to connect and move things forward. So join me and become an Everyday Ambassador, coming to you this spring on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen.